and it has become a very dangerous situation in the Red Sea. So again, these strikes are long overdue, but I will remind everyone, this is retaliation for strikes against our own people and innocent civilians that are operating shipping carriers.
That was Senator Joni Ernst, as she echoed what a lot of folks are saying, too little too late with the assault on some Yemeni installations owned by the Houthis. To help us unpack what's going on in the Middle East, that tinderbox over there is Dakota Wood, retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel and Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at Heritage, and a good friend of national security, peace, and prosperity in the American way, and this show. How you doing, Dakota? Good to talk with you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. I wish we had less troubled times as we got into 2024.
You know, it just seems like the way of the Democrats, starting with Obama, when you think about Middle East tensions of late, the last, 15 years now, with an interlude with Donald Trump, has been a lot of mouth, no big stick, and then when they do wield the stick, it's a twig. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. Sort of. I mean, it just seems like if they'd have acted more decisively earlier, with less talk and more action, that we wouldn't be worried about really the evolving, what many of us are worrying about, is a world war on the edge. What do you say?
Well, the philosophy in on the Democrat or the liberal side of foreign policy and those sorts of things really echoes what you see across Europe. I mean, it's the same kind of view. And this view is that talk gets you about everything you want, or people can be bought off. And by that, I mean some kind of a trade, you know, deal, or we try to help them solve some kind of root problem, like joblessness, or you're not growing enough corn, or whatever that might be. And that view refuses to acknowledge the reality of huge swaths of the world, which is based on power, right? It's either tribal or clan or family or ethnic group or religious group, you know, whatever those identities are that are very strongly held. Whoever the leader is or the people involved in that group or entity cannot allow themselves to be minimalized, marginalized, or destroyed or subjugated. And so there's this power dynamic. So we have academics here in the United States to talk about cultural awareness and understanding, and, you know, trying to do these outreaches and show that other peoples, that America is their friend at all. And that message does not resonate. So what we've seen, Obama was the chief champion of this. The Biden team is an extension of that Obama administration, as you so well pointed out. And so our engagement with the Middle East and in Africa and in much of Asia doesn't acknowledge this power dynamic. So what we think is the outreach of a friend's hand is seen as weakness and supplication, right, from the other side, and they take advantage of that every single time. I just don't understand why that isn't acknowledged in D.C. unless there is risk aversion and a fear of having to use power, and then you get embroiled in some kind of a war, and everybody hates that.
Well, and I guess we can, I guess, being truth seekers, and I know you are, I guess we can hold the Bush administration and, you know, to some extent, George W. Mm-hmm. Bush, accountable for maybe not having clearly defined objectives and tactical strategies, including rules of engagement and so forth. I mean, you're a military strategist. You've organized those things both on the strategic and tactical level. So, I mean, you know, there's culpability on both sides. But at the end of the day, if we had the old shock and awe philosophy, you know, from the old Kuwait Iraq conflict, mm-hmm. man, that came to an end in a big hurry. It seems to me like we could learn from that history and learn an awful lot and quell what's going on in the Middle East a lot more efficiently, couldn't we?
Yeah. So the Bush family really illustrates, I'm glad you brought that up, the two sides of this. So Dad, George H.W. Bush, got together a coalition of a lot of Arab partners and kicked Iraq out of Kuwait. That was the objective. And then there was the highway of death, you know, destroying the Iraqi military power as it was withdrawing from Kuwait into Iraq. But when that objective had been achieved, H.W. Bush realized that if we went in further into Iraq to try to depose Saddam Hussein, you would lose all that Arab support, and it would look like a unilateral, you know, U.S. imperialist sort of thing. And so he accomplished the objective. Everybody came home. There was some criticism about that because of what Saddam Hussein did to some of the ethnic groups in that area. But it just wasn't achievable in that time to do anything else. His son then rightly responded to the attacks of 9/11, tore through the Taliban to get to Al-Qaeda, and the military objectives were achieved there. But then it flipped, and we wanted to create a little America in Afghanistan, right? That all the little kids needed a school, all the women needed to drive, it needed to have equal representation in government, all these Western ideas that did not mesh with the cultural, historical realities and religious realities in that part of the world. And so we gooned that all up, and we repeated that mistake in Iraq in 2004. You know, the military thing in 2003 worked well. All the insurgency, not allowing previous Ba'ath Party officials to be part of the government, and all these other mistakes. And so you're right. It's both Republicans and Democrats not having a good read of the world and trying to do things that just would require 200 years to take root. And we think we can accomplish results in 24 months.
Yeah. You know, there's no doubt that that's a noble goal, but it's just unrealistic.
It is.
And W had his rose-colored glasses on. So let's pivot to what's actually going on over there in the Red Sea and Yemen. It appears as though this was a U.S.-UK-led, along with some Western allies, assault. We don't know how targeted. It didn't appear to go after Houthi leaders. But on the heels of that, Dakota, rhetorically, and if you look at the images coming out of Yemen, holy cow, it seems like we've opened up a hornet's nest over there. I mean, what happened, what should have happened, and what might happen going forward?
Yeah, well, for two or three months now, the Houthis, which is started off as a religious movement in Yemen and then turned anti-government and then into kind of an insurgent rebel sort of thing with the backing of Iran, has been waging war for 20 years against the Yemeni government. The Yemeni government is backed by Saudi Arabia. So this conflict turned into a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, with the combatants being the Yemeni government and the Houthis. So that was going on in 15 or 20 years. When October 7th happened, with Hamas terrorists attacking that horrifically into Israel, you know, we know what the response to that was been. And so war between Israel and Hamas. The Houthis then decided that they would participate in an indirect sort of way, you know, to support Hamas. And so they started launching some things in the direction of Israel. Those were all shot down. So they had turned their attention then to international shipping, with this argument that somehow or other Israeli-related container vessels and ships were legitimate targets. Well, obviously they weren't. But the Houthis started impacting global shipping in international waters and then started taking shots at U.S. Navy ships in the area. So that's been going on for a couple of months now. 27 attacks, I believe, of international shipping in the last 2 months. U.S. forces in the region have been attacked 130 times since October 7th as well. And so finally, after a lot of pressure, the Biden administration decided to retaliate. And they hit something like 60 or 70 targets at a dozen or more, 16 or so locations, using about 140 weapons, Tomahawk cruise missiles, other types of missiles. The Brits employed a fighter strike package with some bombs and went after logistics capabilities, all the support bases for the drones and the missile shots that have been going on, radar installations, command and control facilities, and all that. So it was a massive overnight strike that degraded the ability of the Houthis to do something, but it certainly didn't eliminate it. Remember, they've been at war for 20 years, so they've got a lot of stuff, and they know what warfare is like. But it was a message to the Houthis and to the Iranians, their sponsors. And we'll have to see whether they decide to continue with this harassment of shipping or whether they have gotten the message. And I think they'll continue, and we'll revisit this kind of a strike thing in the next few weeks.
Dakota Wood, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at Heritage, joins us. Okay, so I guess I have to ask you, I have not heard reporting, Dakota, and maybe that's because I'd like to think it's under the covers of Blinken, of defense, I mean, of, you know, of the security people,
Austin,
and of the, and other people talking with Iran in the meantime, saying, look, this was just a little taste of what we're capable of. Back off. I mean, all we've heard publicly is the word don't. You know, starting with Biden and then Austin. Do you think that this kind of a, I mean, as I understand it, the secret sauce for international security and for our national security is a strong military deterrent with kinetic action that's targeted and defined and swift and severe, as you've defined it. But on the back end, that driving successful diplomacy on the other end that says, hey, look, you do what you want in your country, but stop messing with us. Do you think those conversations are going on, or are they still playing patsy cake with the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, I think it's both. When you do not have direct relations, like the U.S. doesn't have direct communications with North Korea, we don't have with Iran. So you have these second and third parties. It could be business folks. It could be some other country like Oman or the folks in Qatar or maybe the Swiss. I mean, there are different routes to get official communications passed through this very indirect way. And then you have these public statements, you know, that go out to the global audience, and those are worded in a way to kind of deliver a message. So I know that those things are happening. The Iranians, for example, are not stupid. I mean, you know, they're a near nuclear power, highly educated. You know, they know what's going on, but they know where their interests are at and how they want to dominate the region. So the background chatter is occurring. At the same time, you can also have a very weak, you know, wimpy sort of policy engagement strategy. You know, the Democrats are desperate to have this nuclear thing reprised. That's not going to happen. You know, as close as Iran is to getting nuclear weapons, and some estimates have been enough 90% grade enriched uranium that they could turn out in 3 or 4 weeks, given what they've already accumulated in their technical capabilities. So the Democrats would love to have some kind of a deal, as Obama struck, which was horrible, but they want to have that. And we haven't taken any direct action against Iran, because that would open up another whole problem set with the energy shipping out of the Persian Gulf, you know, into the Gulf of Oman and the Red Sea and stuff, so or the Arabian Sea. So it's a complicated web of economic interests, the use of military power, and our military is very weak, not in its people. We've got great people, but we have half the size of the military we did it during the Cold War. It doesn't train enough, and we use very old equipment. So there's a numbers game here about how much stuff the U.S. can have in that region relative to the objective that you're trying to achieve. And so all of this stuff swirls around Washington, D.C., and the White House, and the Defense Department, and the State Department about what you think you can do, and then do your words match your capabilities?
Mm-hmm. And you and Jim Talent laid that very frightening reality of our actual, you know, materiel erosion and deficit, you know, as it relates to the Ukrainian conflict and everything last year at the News Talk STL event. Final thing. Okay, all of us who are, well, those of us who are not military, but I have a son-in-law who's in the military. Boy, I'm hyper aware of chain of command, the very rigid hierarchical structure. Man, rules, right? Salute. Yes, sir. No, sir. Okay. And then we see the folly going on with Austin and the deputy, and Biden doesn't know what's going on. And I mean, this is, while I don't really need to know that it was prostate cancer, I think the media, I don't know why they have this curious knowledge. I mean, someone needs to know what the prognosis is and what his capabilities are. I'm less worried about that, but that was a terrible lapse of leadership, no? And ongoing.
it was a terrible lapse of judgment. And what it did was it revealed problematic communications between key people, that assumptions were in place, complacency was in place. You've got whoever runs the station there in St. Louis, that individual or group of senior officers in the company are doing lots of things. And you might not hear from somebody for a day or two, but your assumption is they're talking with other people, you know, that the machine continues to run. And so that's okay, unless you're the president, secretary of defense, director of national intelligence. Those people should always know where each other is at, because stuff happens in the world. You know, October 7th, right, against Israel, or, missile strikes, from Yemen out to international shipping or something like that. So it is routine protocol in every other instance I'm aware of, where the daily schedule and the location of key individuals is shared with the chiefs of staff or the military assistants or whomever that might be amongst all these principals. And that completely broke down. And what was even weirder is that Kathleen Hicks, who's the deputy secretary of defense, on vacation, that's fine. People do this sorts of things. But when she was given additional authorities that would normally be held by the secretary of defense, she accepted those. Okay, I've got it. I've got the communications and stuff to do that. But she didn't ask why. So what's with the boss? Where is the secretary at that I'm being delegated these authorities? So simple questions weren't even asked. And it just shows that things had gotten too complacent and too loose. Horrible lapses of judgment in this sort of thing. And, people are rightly criticizing and asking how this could have happened.
Well, I don't know if it really applies in this particular scenario, but a lot of us look at the social engineering and experimentation going on and in the military, and you wonder if they're just not distracted with their hands and trying to make too many pies. Stick to what your core mission is and stop the other nonsense.
It reflects a lack of seriousness. Right. That we can debate gender. I mean, and what is a man and what is a woman? We can debate all that stuff, but we don't pay enough attention to nuclear weapons, military readiness, replacing old gear. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, maybe KJP is really in control. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that could be.
Yeah. God help us. Dakota, there is no one that knows more about this from all levels than Dakota Wood. And we thank you for spending the time with us this Saturday. Stay warm, my friend.
Thank you. Great blessing for me to be with you. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Dakota. There he is, Dakota Wood. Man, those are great discussions. When we come back, your thoughts. Should Austin be fired? Should he resign? What should we do? That and more. Oh, including what Hertz Rent-A-Car is doing with their electric vehicles. That'll tell you a sign of the times. And Virginia Cruda coming up at 7:45. Don't go anywhere. Daily, yes, daily, not once, but more than once, I am telling patients, go see my friends, Dr. Daniel Cusumato and Dr. Megan Dwyer, my dentists at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles. Now, why do I do that? It's not because I look at their pearly whites and say, oh, you're never going to be on the Golden Globes or Fox News if you don't have pearly whites. It's because I'm worried about their inflammation and about their overall oral health. Sometimes they chew tobacco and I like, hey, you got to get a good oral exam. I did my exam, but they have special tools there. Oh, you're having a headache. You're having jaw pain because you grind at night. Go see them. They can take care of these kind of things. Oh, you're having a little problem with, some difficulty with gums and maybe inflammation from that. Yeah, they emphasize that. So whether it is general preventive dentistry, fixing and repairing broken teeth and things and doing, the regular restorative stuff, or whether it's taking care of that overworked masseter. That's the muscle that you grind with here when you grind because you're so angry at what they're doing at the White House. They can take care of it at Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles. Check them out at AdvancedDentistryNow.com. That's AdvancedDentistryNow.com. Or call 978-0226, 636-978-0226. No one better than Advanced Dentistry of St. Charles.
Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer on News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter.
Hey, it's Vic Porcelli. Come hang out with Ken Williams and me every Monday through Friday from 9 to 11. Right now, it's back to the Randy Tober Show on 101.9 and 94.1 News Talk STL.
See, Jerome knows how to light the fire of Randy Tober on a Saturday morning. Play some of that great late 70s, 80s horn band music. That was the days when bands were bands and rhythm section, horns. Last I heard, Jim Pankow, the trombone player with Chicago, is still going strong. I mean, the guy, I don't know, he sort of got that RFK Jr. thing going on. He's always been really buff, and I think he takes good care of himself. He's a super athletic guy. He wrote a lot of the tunes that Chicago made famous. Anyway, that's good. Thanks for that, Jerome. That's good. It's important. We've come to an agreement. I don't know, Jerome, if you do you like hair band, heavy metal rock and rap? Because I've ruled those off limits. That's we can't do that. Do you like those?
Yeah, I was getting excited to see if there's anything like really high energy, but you told me that stuff is off limits, so I guess I'll keep it a little bit more friendly. Personally, yeah, I'm the more extreme like metal, some of the old school rap. Oh. But I do also enjoy like Dave Brubeck Quartet, Frank Zappa, some of the old guys. Yeah, it's just whatever sticks out to me. It's amazing.
Chet Baker. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so here's the deal. If you can come up with something that has some meat to it in the rap genre or in the heavy metal genre, I'm a tolerant and curious, constant learner, lifelong learner, and I can expand my horizons, but only if the horizons don't lead to perdition and, you know, dumbing my very limited brain down. I can't dumb it down anymore because I'm already a knuckle dragging Neanderthal conservative. Don't you know? I mean, that's what the left and the academics think of us anyway. So we have to, if we're going to play music, it has to have substance. It has to have oomph. It has to be musical. A lot of the rap doesn't have, it's not musical. There's not a melody to it. You know,
yeah, I mean, not anymore.
How can you, I mean, I look and I, my kids laugh at me. They make fun of me, but Will Smith used to do some rap. Now, I could listen to that because it was melodic. It sort of makes sense. There was common sense. There was a story, you know, to the lyrics. But some of this stuff, and you know what? The other thing is I'm worried about rap, at least in some of its forms, being very erosive to those cultures that need some positive, dare I say, Disney-esque messaging. You know, they need some positive messaging, not, you know, you know, my girlfriend's my bee and this, she's a hoe and she's, I mean, that's the way you talk about women? I couldn't believe it. And every other word's an F-bomb in some of the rap. I can't, not good. I know you don't listen to that kind of stuff. Well, you come up with it. We'll try it out and we'll do a thumbs up, thumbs down. Maybe the audience can weigh in as well, you know, see. All right. Look, this is an important election. By the way, Virginia Cruda joins us in a bit, and I'm going to talk to her about what her thoughts are about the GOP primaries, the town hall with Trump last week, and the debate at the same time, the CNN debate with DeSantis and Haley, and other sundry things. But, you know, as I watch this election cycle evolve, we're seeing, I think there's a little bit of a sea change in the culture at large, and especially in, I think, the middle of the voting block. As we know, most of you listening to this broadcast and that tune into this station, you're going to probably vote for whoever ends up being the nominee for the Republican Party. There may be a few. I've had people call me and I've had people text me and say, Randy, unless it's Donald Trump, I will not vote for Nikki Haley. I will not vote for Nikki Haley. And does that mean you're going to vote for RFK or you're going to stay home? That's a vote for Biden. And we ask this question every election cycle. Are you going to fall on the sword for Puritanism from a political ideological standpoint? Or are you going to do something better than anything the other side offered? Nikki Haley in her worst day politically is better than any Democrat you can throw up against her, anyone. But there are people who will stay home if it isn't Donald Trump. I think, but that's a whole nother discussion. But for the middle of the voting block that will determine the outcome of this election, and only in a few states, by only maybe up to 100,000 votes total, those people are beginning to see a change. the reporting of companies backing off of DEI, the absurd testimony of the academic elite presidents, two of whom resigned shortly after in the last month. We're beginning to see a retraction from this torrent of wokeness. Why do we call it wokeness when it's actually brokenness? In a cultural sense, it's brokenness. There's no other way to describe it. You are culturally bankrupt if you think that DEI and CRT and, you know, regulatory racism is the way to cure whatever ills remain in American society. I'm sorry. Have another puff. Spend more time at the dispensary. I'm sorry. You're wrong. Okay, that said, good news out of Hertz. I don't think I've ever rented or have you ever rented a Hertz rental car? Jerome, I don't know. Have you? I never have.
No, actually.
But they're a big name.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Most of the time when I'm renting, I need a truck to move stuff. So I don't think I've really had to go to them too much.
Well, let me know. I got a big truck. I'll come down if you can rent a trailer from somewhere and we'll move your stuff. Let me know.
Yeah, I mean, we're just trying to get a couch right now, so that'd be very helpful. If anybody's got a truck that I could borrow, that'd be fantastic.
So Hertz has announced that they're going to sell 20,000 electric vehicles from their fleet due to low demand and higher costs. They're going to use some of the money raised, get this, to buy gas-powered cars. This is where you need to have that little stinger with the heavens are opening. Oh, finally, they've seen the light, right? Axios reported the move marks an abrupt reversal by Hertz, which in 2022 announced plans to buy 165,000 EVs from Tesla and Volvo. And said the move means this is a $245 million loss. Now, that is a cultural statement. That is a statement that Republican candidates from a school board candidate to the president of the United States should remind people of. When you have iconic businesses that are backing away from this absurd, falling on the sword economically move towards so-called sustainable energy, that tells you something. We need to celebrate that. I may go out and rent a Hertz now. The next time I may pay a little bit more. Usually I do budget or dollar or something, you know, whatever. I get a 1956 Studebaker because it's the cheapest thing that, you know, that you can get. I don't think they rent Studebakers though. But this is good news. This is good news, and I'm thankful for Hertz doing that. This is the first major company to end up with buyer's remorse for launching into EVs. Town Hall reported in December that Ford dealt a blow to the energy transition pipe dream. Remember, they cut planned production of all of its electric F-150 Lightning pickup trucks, or planned production, I'm sorry, half of its all electric. So, look, things are moving. The wheels are turning towards some normalcy, towards some rational thinking, towards some, wait a minute, let's step back. This rush to this craziness, we got to let the market develop this. When the government mandates something, it never works out well. I can tell you that from healthcare. Our healthcare payment system is absolutely in shambles. The delivery of high technology healthcare, yeah, doing okay. Low technology primary care doctor, try to get a primary care doctor and get them to see you sooner than a couple of 3 or 4 weeks. It's so gratifying in our new practice where we just have a subscription model. I see patients that afternoon or the next day. I mean, it's great, and they like it. I like it. It's rewarding. It's fulfilling. But guess what? The insurance companies are fighting that, and so is the government, because the government and so are employers. They want to own your health care. They don't want you to own your health care. That's a whole other thing. So before we get to Virginia Cruda, you know what? Why don't we get to Virginia Cruda? Let's have more time for Virginia. We never have enough time for her. So we'll step aside, fill up your coffee cup, get your little Danish or whatever kind of a pastry. What kind of pastry you have this morning there, Jerome? You got a morning donut? Nothing?
Oh, no. I have to be here pretty early, so I actually usually skip breakfast. I know that's bad for me, but I'll get in a better
Oh, not soon. Good for you. Yeah, you gotta fuel that brilliant brain of yours, man. Gotta do that. And then we'll step aside. Please take a listen to our sponsors and listen to them seriously. And if you need their services, when you need their services, use them. That's what keeps the great programming here on News Talk STL alive and well and free. Increasingly, people are charging for things. I notice the Blaze now is charging. All kinds. Everyone's putting a... This is free. It's all free. And it's because you support our sponsors. So please take that to heart. Okay, we'll be back on the Tober Show on News Talk STL 101.9 94.1. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, everybody. Tony Colombo and Katie Fitzpatrick here.
Thanks for listening to the Randy Tober Show here on News Talk STL. And don't forget to join us every weekday at 2 p.m. for Colombo and Katie.
Also, keep it here for my Saturday morning show, the Bluff City Outdoor Show, today at 11. Now back to Dr. Randy Tobler. Love you, Doc.
Love you, too. You know, this is a big family here, and we're glad you're a part of it when you tune in to News Talk STL, whether it's on the traditional radio airwaves. I have a radio that I actually tune into. I like to pull it out once in a while, like I'm working in the garden, and you know, during the better time of the year. It actually has the knobs that turn the analog dial, and I listen that way. Or through the app, which is awesome, or just on the web. You can do it that way, or on your Alexa. It's an Alexa skill as well. So lots of ways. Or on YouTube, Facebook, or Rumble. So that's great. And you can hear the great, great analysis of Virginia Cruda every week here with us. And we're appreciative of that, as well as throughout the week in various formats, written and spoken. Daily Wire contributor as well. How you doing, Virginia? Thanks for being with us. You staying warm?
Yeah, I'm good. It just... You know, we can listen on YouTube until they kick us off again, right?
Yeah, I know. I keep trying to say something that'll get us kicked off. I hope management didn't hear that. I'm kidding. We don't purposely try to do that. But, you know, management, that's what's really cool. Management doesn't tell us, hey, if you say this, you'll get cooked off. If you say that, it tells us to say what we want to say. It's great. I mean, I just love working for Jeff and Joe and the team. I mean, it's great, great, great.
Yeah.
So listen, we had this sort of, back and forth with DeSantis and Haley and who could be more shrill against one another. All the while, Trump was knocking it out of the park, you know, in the town hall the other night. Do you think anything, is this a done deal? Are the caucuses going to be real yawners tomorrow? Or, I'm sorry, on Monday, Virginia?
You know, I don't know. I know DeSantis has been doing a really, a lot of legwork in Iowa. And because of the trials and his inability to, you know, sometimes keep his foot out of his mouth, Trump has not been on the ground in Iowa, the kind of presence that he might have been. But because he is the former president and he already had the name recognition, I mean, that's one of the reasons that you go and do the legwork in Iowa, so that people know who you are. You know.
Yeah, you're right.
They already know who he is. Will what DeSantis did matter? That's the question.
Well, and here's the other thing, Virginia. There's two other developments. One was when Chris Christie, the very night of that debate and town hall, he backed out, and you wrote about it. I mean, Chris Christie was caught on the hot mic saying that, you know, Haley doesn't have the stuff, right? And mm-hmm. secondly, you know, that DeSantis is terrified. Well, I guess what's he terrified of? That Haley's going to get Christie's votes? So what do you think about, is that going to have any impact, that hot mic moment? And what will happen to Christie's? I mean, he had, you know, high single digit in many polls. He had, that's a significant number of voters, of caucus goers. Are they going to sit home? Will they mostly go to one or the other? Will there be a diaspora? That's the word, Jerome, for the morning, a diaspora of voters across Iowa political landscape.
Polling suggests that most of Christie's supporters, their second choice is Haley. But then you've got Rand Paul, who came out yesterday with his never Nikki.
We have it. Here's an anti-endorsement from Rand Paul. Listen.
Good morning, everyone. As I told you yesterday, I'm ready to say something about the presidential race. I've had a long relationship with Donald Trump, and there's a lot to like there. I'm also a big fan of a lot of the fiscal conservatism of Ron DeSantis. I think Vivek Ramaswamy has been an important voice. Also, have listened to and met with the independent Bobby Kennedy. I'm not yet ready to make a decision, but I am ready to make a decision on someone who I cannot support. So I'm announcing this morning that I'm Never Nikki. And if you go to nevernikki.net, you can let her know that you're not a supporter either. I don't think any informed or knowledgeable libertarian or conservative should support Nikki Haley. I've seen her attitude towards our interventions overseas. I've seen her involvement in the military-industrial complex, $8 million being paid to become part of the team. But I've also seen her indicate that she thinks you should be registered to use the internet, that people posting ideas anonymously. I think she fails to understand that our republic was founded upon people.
So that gives you a flavor of it. I mean, I don't recall an anti-endorsement like that, except from Chris Christie, Virginia. You think it'll have any impact?
The entire Never Trump movement is an anti-endorsement. I mean,
You're right. Let's
be real. I mean, and here's what I dislike about this. I like Rand Paul. In fact, I wish that maybe he was running, because I think that he's an important voice sometimes. And he's the kind of guy, he's a decent campaigner, and he doesn't push over easily. And he doesn't change his opinions from debate to debate, where you see some of the candidates kind of their policies and their platforms kind of reshape throughout the campaign. You don't really see that from Rand Paul, because he is what he is. And I like that about him. Now, what I don't like is that he's standing up and suggesting that somehow, in the grand scheme of things, Bobby Kennedy might be a better candidate for the United States at this moment than Nikki Haley. And I think that at the end of the day, any Republican that we have would be better than any Democrat that they have. And I'm sorry, he can call himself independent all day long, but Bobby Kennedy's a Democrat.
Yeah.
So that
I agree with you, but there's a lot of people that I was saying it previously here earlier in the show, Virginia, that I have been texted, I've been called on the air by people who say, if it's not Trump, I'm not voting. Or conversely, if it's Haley, I'm not voting. I mean, I'm not going to vote for Nikki Haley, which is a vote for Biden.
And I have a very big problem with the never anything anybody's. Okay, I don't like Never Trump, whether I like Trump or not. I don't like Never Trump. I don't like Never DeSantis. I don't like Never Haley. The only thing that we should be never is never Biden, never Democrat, because the reality is, anything we have on this side is going to be better for this country than anything that they have on the opposite side.
Yep.
And we have primaries for a reason. That is so you can vote for the best possible candidate. But once you get to the general election, sometimes you have to vote for the least bad candidate, because you're preventing something worse from happening. And
couldn't agree with you more.
The people who are unwilling to do that frustrate me to no end, because I get you don't want to vote for something you don't like, but sometimes you're not voting for, sometimes you're voting against, and you have to understand that, or we end up with Joe Biden.
Well, yeah, I mean, think about it. Vince Lombardi, the famed coach of the Green Bay Packers, Vince Lombardi, proved that defense, a strong impermeable defense, can win the Super Bowl, you know? So that's
right. And that's what I'm saying. So, like, you can hate Trump as much as you want, but until you recognize that, no, he's not actually doing as much damage as Biden did, then we have a problem.
Because the people who sit there
and say, well, Trump is actually doing more damage than Biden, show me your proof. Well, he said this. Okay, he said a lot of things, but look at what he did in 4 years. And tell me how that's more damaging than what Biden has done. Because we all know that politicians talk a lot and do different things than they say. Trump included.
Yep.
So,
all right, Virginia, I want, before we run out of time, we've got a couple of minutes here. I wanted to get, you wrote a nice piece on the Daily Wire that was about this Fannie Willis, who has her Fannie in a bunch of trouble because she hires her boyfriend, overpays him, and then they go on these exotic vacations. He's got a $100,000 Audi. And then it turns out he visited the White House, and so did she, while all of the indictment deliberations were going on. What the heck? This is corruption at the highest level.
Yeah, well, here's the, what's really kind of sheds the light on what all that's going on. This is a guy, Nathan Wade is the name of the attorney, was kind of a no name before she picked him to lead this Trump prosecution. And you would think that you're going after a former president, you want a guy who's got a reputation for getting the job done, right? The last major job he was selected to do, after months and months of research and being on the job, they asked him, what kind of evidence did he have? And he said he hadn't really taken any notes. He just had his brainchild of what was going on. That's how he put it.
Ooh, wow.
Right? And so this is the guy that she selects to prosecute Trump. Then follow that with the fact that twice before they even charge Trump, he's been to the White House.
Yeah. Well, it was probably just on a tour, just a citizen tour. You know, you can sign up for those.
No, it actually said he met the White House counsel.
I know.
And he charged him and he billed him for 8 hours. So
I know. I saw that.
Yeah.
Well,
so
I don't know. This is just so corrupt.
He billed for 16 hours prior to this, to the tune of like $4,000. He billed,
and again,
the county.
Yeah, we should say this is all alleged in a claim by a filing by Michael Roman, who is of course under indictment.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's a great piece.
He provided receipts, so that he did bill the White House, or didn't bill the White House. Right. He billed the county, Fulton County, Georgia, for the interviews that he did with the White House that amounted to 16 hours.
Okay. Virginia, we got to run. Great stuff. We look forward to hearing and reading more from you. Thanks so much. Stay warm, okay?
You too.
All right. There she is, Virginia Cruda. We'll be back with more at the top of the hour. Todd Showalter joins us.